The gunshot is deafening. The muzzle flash is blinding. Amanda drops like someone flipped a power switch, and next to me, my Amanda lets slip a stifled shriek. As this other Jason rushes Layton, the second guard executes a lightning-fast taser draw and brings him down screaming and twitching on the floor of the hangar. My Amanda's shriek has given us away. Layton is staring right at us with a look of pure confusion. He shouts, "Hey!" They start after us. I grab Amanda by the arm and drag her back through the door of the box and slam it home. The door locks, the corridor reconstitutes, but the drug will be wearing off any moment now. Amanda is quaking, and I want to tell her everything is fine, but it isn't. She just witnessed her own murder. "That isn't you out there," I tell her. "You're standing right here beside me, alive and well. That is not you." Even in the bad light, I can tell she's crying. Tears streak down through the grime on her face like running eyeliner. "It's some part of me," she says. "Or was." Gently, I reach down and lift her arm, turning it so I can see the watch. We're 45 seconds shy of the 90-minute mark. I say, "We have to go." I start down the corridor. "Amanda, come on!" When she catches up, I open a door. Total darkness. No sound, no smell. Just a void. I slam it shut. Try not to panic, but I need to be opening more doors, giving us a shot at finding some place to rest and reset. I open the next door. 10 feet away, standing in weeds in front of a teetering chain-link fence, a wolf glares at me through large amber eyes. Lowering its head, it growls. As it starts toward me, I shove the door closed. Amanda grabs hold of my hand. We keep walking. I should be opening more doors, but the truth is, I'm terrified. I've lost faith we'll find a world that's safe. I blink, and we're confined to a single box again. The drug has worn off for one of us. This time, she opens the door. Snow streams into the box. A shot of bitter cold hits my face. Through a curtain of falling snow, I glimpse the silhouettes of trees nearby and houses in the distance. "What do you think?" I ask. "I think I don't want to be in this box for another fucking second." Amanda steps down into the snow and sinks to her knees in the soft powder. She immediately begins to shiver. I feel the drug wink out for me, and this time the sensation is like an ice pick through my left eye. Intense, but fleeting. I follow Amanda out of the box, and we head in the general direction of the neighborhood. Beyond the initial layer of powder, I can feel myself continuing to sink, the weight of each step slowly breaking through a deeper, older crust of compacted snow. I catch up with Amanda. We trudge through a clearing toward a neighborhood, which seems to be slowly vanishing before my eyes. While I'm marginally protected from the cold in my pair of jeans and hoodie, Amanda is suffering in her red skirt, black sweater, and flats. I've lived most of my life in the Midwest, and I've never known cold like this. My ears and cheekbones are rocketing toward frostbite, and I'm already beginning to lose the fine motor control in my hands. A driving wind blasts us straight on, and as the snow intensifies, the world ahead takes on the appearance of a furiously shaken snow globe. We push on through the snow, moving as quickly as we can, but it's getting deeper and nearly impossible to navigate with anything approaching efficiency. Amanda's cheeks have gone blue. She's violently shivering. Her hair is matted with snow. "We should go back," I say through chattering teeth. The wind has grown deafening. Amanda looks at me, confused, then nods. I glance back, but the box is gone. My fear spikes. The snow is blowing sideways, and the houses in the distance have vanished. In every direction, it all looks the same. Amanda's head is nodding up and down, and I keep squeezing my hands into fists, trying to force warm blood through to my fingertips, but it's a losing battle. My ring of thread is encrusted with ice. My thought processes are beginning to spin out. I'm shaking with cold. We fucked up. It isn't just cold. It's way below zero cold. Lethally cold. I have no idea how far we've come from the box. Does it even matter anymore when we're functionally blind? This cold will kill us in a matter of minutes. Keep moving. Amanda has a faraway look in her eyes, and I wonder if it's the shock setting in. Her bare legs are in direct contact with the snow.
It hurts, she says.
Bending down, I lift her in my arms and stagger into the storm, holding Amanda tightly against me as her entire body shakes. We're standing in a vortex of wind and snow and killing cold, and it all looks exactly the same. If I don't stare down at my legs, the motion of it all induces vertigo. It occurs to me, we're going to die. But I keep going. One foot in front of the other, my face now on fire from the cold, my arms aching from holding Amanda, my feet in agony as the snow works down into my shoes. Minutes pass, and the snow falls harder and the cold keeps biting. Amanda is mumbling, delirious. I can't keep doing this, can't keep walking, can't keep holding her. Soon, so soon, I will have to stop. We'll sit in the snow and hold this woman I barely know, and we will freeze to death together in this awful world that isn't even ours. I think about my family, think about not ever seeing them again, and I try to process what that means as my control over the fear finally slips. There's a house in front of us, or rather, the second story of a house, because its first floor has been completely buried in snow that's drifted all the way up to a trio of dormer windows. Amanda! Her eyes are closed. Amanda! She opens them, barely. Stay with me. I set her down in the snow against the roof, stumble toward the middle dormer, and put my foot through the window. When I've kicked out all the sharpest jags of glass, I take hold of Amanda by her arms and pull her down into a child's bedroom, a little girl's by the looks of it. Stuffed animals, a wooden dollhouse, princess paraphernalia, a Barbie flashlight on the bedside table. I drag Amanda far enough into the room that the snow pouring through the window can't reach her. Then I grab the Barbie flashlight and move through the doorway into an upstairs hall. I call out, "Hello?" The house swallows my voice, gives nothing back. All the bedrooms on the second floor stand empty. In most of them, the furniture has been removed. Turning on the flashlight, I head down the staircase. The batteries are low, the bulb emits a weak beam. Moving off the stairs, I pass the front door into what used to be a dining room. Boards have been nailed across the window frames to support the glass against the pressure of the snow, which fills the frames entirely. An axe leans on the remnants of a dining room table that's been chopped down into burnable pieces of kindling. I step through a doorway that opens into a smaller room. The tepid light beam strikes a couch. A pair of chairs almost completely stripped of their leather. A television mounted above a fireplace overflowing with ashes. A box of candles. A stack of books. Sleeping bags, blankets, and pillows have been spread across the floor in the vicinity of the fireplace, and there are people inside them. A man, a woman, two teenage boys, a young girl. Eyes closed, not moving. Their faces blue and emaciated. A framed photograph of the family at the Lincoln Park Conservatory, in a better time, rests on the woman's chest, her blackened fingers still clutched around it. Along the hearth, I see matchboxes, stacks of newspaper, a pile of wood shavings harvested from a cutlery block. A second doorway out of the family room brings me into the kitchen. The refrigerator is open and barren, and the cabinets too.
The countertops are covered with empty metal cans. Creamed corn, kidney beans, black beans, whole peeled tomatoes, soups, peaches. The stuff that lives in the backs of cabinets and usually just expires from neglect. Even the condiment jars have been scraped clean. Mustards, mayonnaise, jellies. Behind the overflowing trash can, I see a frozen puddle of blood and a skeleton. Small, feline, stripped to the bone. These people didn't freeze to death. They starved. Firelight glows on the walls of the family room. I'm naked in a sleeping bag that's inside of a sleeping bag that's covered in blankets. Amanda thaws out beside me in two sleeping bags of her own. Our wet clothes are drying on the brick hearth, and we're lying close enough to the fire that I can feel the warmth of it lapping at my face. Outside, the storm rages on, the entire framework of the house creaking in the strongest gusts of wind. Amanda's eyes are open. She's been awake a little while, and we've already killed the two bottles of water, which are now packed with snow and standing on the hearth near the fire.
"What do you think happened to whoever lived here?" she asks.
Truth, I dragged their bodies into an office so she wouldn't see them. But I say, "I don't know, maybe they went somewhere warm?" She smiles.
"Liar. We're not doing so hot with our spaceship."
I think this is what they call a steep learning curve. She draws in a long, deep breath, lets it out. Says,
"I'm 41. It wasn't the most amazing life, but it was mine. I had a career, an apartment, a dog, friends, TV shows I liked to watch. This guy, John, I'd seen 3 times. Wine."
She looks at me.
"I'm never going to see any of that again, am I?"
I'm not certain how to respond. She continues.
"At least you have a destination. A world you want to get back to. I can't return to mine, so where does that leave me?"
She stares at me, tense, unblinking. I have no answer. The next time I come to consciousness, the fire has reduced itself to a pile of glowing embers, and the snow near the tops of the windows is backlit and sparkling as threads of sunlight attempt to sneak through. Even inside the house, it is inconceivably cold. Reaching a hand out of the sleeping bag, I touch our clothes on the hearth, relieved to find them dry. I pull my hand back inside and turn toward Amanda. She has the sleeping bag pulled over her face, and I can see her breath pushing through the down in puffs of steam that have formed a structure of ice crystals on the surface of the bag. I put on my clothes and build a new fire, and hold my hands in the heat just in time to keep my fingers from going numb. Leaving Amanda to sleep, I walk through the dining room, where the sun cutting through the snow at the top of the windows casts just enough illumination to light my way. Up the dark staircase, down the hall, back into the girls' room, where snow has blown in and covered most of the floor. I climb through the window frame and squint against the painful light, the glare coming off the ice so intense that for 5 seconds I can't see a thing. The snow is waist deep, the sky a perfect blue. No sound of birds, no sound of life. There's not even a whisper of wind and no trace of our tracks, everything smoothed over and drifted. The temperature must be miles below zero, because even in the direct sun, I'm not anywhere close to warm. Beyond this neighborhood, the skyline of Chicago looms, the towers snow-blown and ice-encrusted and glittering in the sun. A white city, a world of ice. Across the street, I survey the open field where we nearly froze to death yesterday. There's no sign of the box. Back inside, I find Amanda awake, sitting up at the edge of the hearth with the sleeping bags and blankets wrapped around her. I head into the kitchen, locate some silverware. Then I open the backpack and dig out a couple of MREs. They're cold, but rich. We eat ravenously. Amanda asks, "Did you see the box?" "No, I think it's buried under the snow." "Fantastic." She looks at me, then back into the flames, says, "I don't know whether to be mad at you or grateful." "What are you talking about?" "While you were upstairs, I had to use the bathroom. I stumbled into the office." "So you saw them?" "They starved, didn't they? Before they ran out of fuel for the fire."
"Looks like it."
As I stare into the flames, I feel something needling the back of my brain. An inkling. It started when I was outside a moment ago, looking at the field, thinking about us almost dying in that whiteout. I say, "Remember what you said about the corridor? How it reminded you of being trapped in a whiteout?" She stops eating, looks at me. "The doors in the corridor are the connections to an infinite array of parallel worlds, right? But what if we're defining these connections?"
"How?"
"What if it's like dream building, where we're somehow choosing these specific worlds?"
"You're saying that, out of an infinite number of realities, I intentionally picked this shithole?"
"Not intentionally. Maybe it's a reflection of what you were feeling at the moment you opened the door." She takes the last bite of food and tosses her empty MRE packet into the fire. I say, "Think about the first world we saw, that ruined Chicago, with the buildings crumbling all around us. What was our emotional state as we walked into that parking garage?"
"Fear? Terror? Despair? Oh my God, Jason!"
"What?"
"Before we opened the door to the hangar and saw the other versions of you and me getting caught, you had mentioned that very thing happening."
"Did I?"
"You were talking about the idea of the multiverse, and everything that can happen will happen. And you said that somewhere there was a version of you and me that never made it into the box. Moments later, you opened a door, and we watched that exact scenario play out."
I feel the spine-tingling rush of a revelation sweeping over me. I say, "This whole time, we've been wondering where the controls are."
"But we're the controls."
"Yep. And if that's the case, then we have the ability to go wherever we want, including home." Early the next morning, we stand in the midst of this silent neighborhood, waist deep in snow and shivering, even though we're wearing layer upon layer of that poor family's winter clothes, which we raided from the coat closet. In the field ahead of us, there's no sign of our tracks, no sign of the box, nothing but smooth, unbroken snow. The field is huge, and the box is tiny. The chances of us stumbling upon it through blind luck are minuscule. With the sun just creeping above the trees, the cold is unreal.
"What are we supposed to do, Jason? Take a guess? Start digging?"
I glance back at the half-buried house, wondering for a terrifying moment how long we could survive there. How long before the firewood ran out, before our food ran out, before we gave up and perished like all the others? I can feel a dark pressure mounting in my chest, fear pushing in. I draw a deep breath into my lungs, and the air is so cold it makes me cough. Panic stalks me from all sides. Finding the box is impossible. It's too cold out here. There won't be enough time, and when the next storm comes, and the next, the box is going to be buried so deep, we'll never have a chance of reaching it. Unless. I let the backpack slide off my shoulders into the snow and unzip it with trembling fingers.
"What are you doing?" Amanda asks.
"Throwing a Hail Mary." It takes me a moment to find what I'm looking for. Grasping the compass, I leave Amanda and the pack and wade into the field. She follows, shouting for me to wait up. 50 feet out, I stop to let her catch up to me. "Look at this," I say, touching the face of the compass. "We're in South Chicago, right?" I point toward the distant skyline. So magnetic north is that way. But this compass says otherwise. See how the needle is pointing east toward the lake? Her face lights up.
Of course! It's the box's magnetic field, pushing the compass needle away from it.
We posthole through the deep powder. In the middle of the field, the needle swings from east to west. We're right on top of it. I begin to dig, my bare hands aching from the snow. But I don't stop. 4 feet down, I hit the edge of the box, and I keep digging, faster now, my sleeves pulled forward to protect my hands, which are passing from a cold-driven agony into numbness. When my half-frozen fingers finally graze the top of the open door, I let out a shout that echoes through the frozen world. 10 minutes later, we're back inside the box, drinking Ampule 46 and Ampule 45. Amanda starts the timer on her watch, kills the lantern to preserve the batteries, and as we sit beside each other in the frigid dark, waiting for the drug to hit, she says,
"Never thought I'd be glad to see our shitty little lifeboat again."
"Right?" She leans her head against my shoulder.
"Thank you, Jason."
"For what?"
"Not letting me freeze to death out there."
"Does this mean we're even?" She laughs.
"Not even close. I mean, let's not forget, this is still all your fault."
It's a strange exercise in sensory deprivation to sit in the total darkness and silence of the box. The only physical sensations are the chill of the metal bleeding through my clothes and the pressure of Amanda's head against my shoulder.
"You're different than him," she says.
"Who?"
"My Jason."
"How so?"
"Softer. He had a real hard edge when you got down to it. The most driven human being I've ever met."
"Were you his therapist?"
"Sometimes."
"Was he happy?" I sense her pondering my question in the dark.
"What?"
I ask. "Am I putting you in a doctor-patient confidentiality quandary?"
"Technically, you two are the same person. It's new territory for sure, but no. I wouldn't say he was happy. He lived an intellectually stimulating but ultimately one-dimensional life. All he did was work. In the last 5 years, he didn't have a life outside the lab. He practically lived there."
"You know, your Jason is the one who did this to me. I'm here right now because several nights ago, someone abducted me at gunpoint while I was walking home. He took me to an abandoned power plant, drugged me, asked me a bunch of questions about my life and the choices I'd made, if I was happy, if I would have done things differently. The memories are back now. Then I woke up in your lab, in your world. I think your Jason did this to me."
"You're suggesting that he went into the box, somehow found your world, your life, and switched places with you?"
"Do you think he was capable?"
"I don't know. That's crazy."
"Who else would have done this to me?" Amanda is quiet for a moment. She says finally,
"Jason was obsessed with the path not taken. He talked about it all the time."
Now I feel the anger coming back. I say, "There's still a part of me that doesn't want to believe it. I mean, if he wanted my life, he could have just killed me. But he went to the trouble of injecting me, not only with an ampule, but ketamine, which rendered me unconscious and blurred my memories of the box and what he'd done. Then he actually brought me back to his world. Why?"
"It actually makes a lot of sense."
"You think?"
"He wasn't a monster. If he did this to you, he would have rationalized it somehow. That's how decent people justify bad behavior. In your world, are you a renowned physicist?"
"No, I teach at a second-rate college."
"Are you wealthy?"
"Professionally and financially speaking, I can't hold a candle to your Jason."
"There you go. He tells himself he's giving you the chance of a lifetime. He wants a shot at the path not taken. Why wouldn't you? I'm not saying it's right. I'm saying that's how a good man works himself up to do a terrible thing. It's human behavior 101.
She must sense my rage building, because she says,
"Jason, you don't have the luxury of freaking out right now. In a minute, we're going back into that corridor. We're the controls. Your words, right?
Yeah.
If that's the truth, if it's our emotional state that's somehow selecting these worlds, to what kind of place is your rage and jealousy going to take us? You can't hold on to this energy as you open a new door. You have to find a way to let it go.
I can feel the drug coming. My muscles relax.
For a moment, the anger vanishes into a river of peace and calm I would give anything to make last, to have carry me through. When Amanda turns on the lantern, the walls perpendicular to the door are gone. I look down at the leather bag that holds the remaining ampules, thinking, if the asshole who did this to me figured out how to navigate the box, then I will too. In the blue light, Amanda watches me. I say, we have 44 ampules left, 22 chances to get this right. How many did the other Jason take with him into the box? 100.
Shit.
I feel a glimmer of panic course through me, but I smile in spite of it.
I guess it's lucky for us I'm way smarter than him, right?
Amanda laughs, rises to her feet, and offers me her hand. We have 1 hour, she says. You up for this?
Absolutely.
9. He gets up earlier. He drinks less, drives faster, reads more, has started exercising, holds his fork differently, laughs more easily, texts less. He takes longer showers, and instead of just running a bar of soap over his entire body, he lathers up a washcloth now. He shaves once every 2 days instead of 4, and at the bathroom sink instead of in the shower. Puts his shoes on immediately after dressing, not at the front door before leaving the house. He flosses regularly, and she actually saw him plucking his eyebrows 3 days ago. He hasn't worn his favorite sleeping shirt, a faded U2 t-shirt from a concert they saw a decade ago at the United Center, in almost 2 weeks. He does the dishes differently. Instead of building an unwieldy tower in the drying rack, he sets the wet plates and glassware on towels that he's spread across the countertop. He drinks 1 cup of coffee with breakfast instead of 2, and he makes it weaker than he used to, so weak, in fact, that she's been making an effort to beat him down to the kitchen each morning to brew the coffee herself. Lately, their family dinner conversations have centered around ideas, books, and articles Jason is reading and Charlie studies, instead of a mundane recounting of the day's events. Speaking of Charlie, Jason is also different with their son. More lenient, less paternal. As if he's forgotten how to be a father to a teenager. He's stopped staying up until 2 every morning watching Netflix on his iPad. He never calls her Danny anymore. He wants her constantly, and it's like their first time every time. He looks at her with a smoldering intensity that reminds her of the way new lovers stare into each other's eyes when there's still so much mystery and uncharted territory to discover. These thoughts, all these tiny realizations, accumulate in the back of her mind as Daniela stands in front of the mirror next to Jason. It's morning, and they're getting ready for their respective days. She's brushing her teeth, he's brushing his. And when he catches her staring at him, he gives a toothpaste foamy grin and winks. She wonders, does he have cancer and isn't telling me? Is he taking a new antidepressant and isn't telling me? Lost his job and isn't telling me? A sick, hot feeling erupts in the pit of her stomach. Is he having an affair with one of his students, and it's her that's making him feel and act like this brand new man? No, none of that feels right. The thing is, nothing is obviously wrong. On paper, they're actually better. He's paying her more attention than he ever has. They haven't talked and laughed this much since the beginning of their relationship. It's just that he's different. Different in 1,000 tiny ways that might mean nothing,
and might mean everything. Jason leans over and spits into the sink. He turns off the faucet and steps around behind her and puts his hands on her hips and pushes up gently against her. She watches his reflection in the mirror, thinking, "What secrets are you keeping?" Wanting to say those words, those exact words. But she keeps brushing, because what if the price tag on that answer is this amazing status quo? He says, "I could just watch you do this all day." "Brush my teeth?" She garbles the words, the toothbrush still in her mouth. "Uh-huh." He kisses the back of her neck, and the shiver goes down her spine and into her knees, and for a split second, it all falls away. The fear, the questions, the doubt. He says, "Ryan Holder is giving a lecture tonight at 6. You want to come with me?" Daniela leans over, spits, rinses. "I'd love to, but I have a lesson at 5:30. "Then can I take you to dinner when I get home?" "I'd love that." She turns around and kisses him. He even kisses differently now, like it's an event, every time. As he starts to pull away, she says, "Hey."
"Yeah?"
She should ask. She should bring up all these things she's noticed. Throw it all down and clear the air. Part of her wants to know so badly. Part of her never wants to know. And so she tells herself that now isn't the time as she plays with his collar and fixes his hair and sends him off into the day with one last kiss. 10. Ampules remaining, 44. Amanda glances up from the notebook, asks,
"You're sure writing it down is the best way to go?"
"When you write something, you focus your full attention on it. It's almost impossible to write one thing while thinking about another. The act of putting it on paper keeps your thoughts and intentions aligned."
"How much should I write?" she asks.
"Maybe keep it simple to start? One short paragraph?" She finishes the sentence she's been working on, closes the notebook, and rises to her feet. "You've got it all in the forefront of your mind?" I ask.
"I think so."
I shoulder our backpack. Amanda crosses to the door, turns the handle, pulls it open. Morning sunlight enters the corridor, so blinding that for a moment I can't see a thing outside. As my eyes adjust to the brilliance, the surroundings fade into focus. We're standing in the doorway of the box, at the top of a hill overlooking a park. To the east, emerald grass slopes for several hundred yards, down to the shore of Lake Michigan. And in the distance rises a skyline like none I've ever seen. The buildings slim, constructions of glass and steel so reflective they border on invisible, creating an effect almost like a mirage. The sky is filled with moving objects, most crisscrossing the airspace above what I assume is Chicago, a few accelerating vertically, straight up into the deep blue, with no sign of stopping. Amanda looks over at me and smirks, tapping the notebook. I open it to the first page. She wrote, "I want to go to a good place, to a good time to be alive, a world I'd want to live in. It isn't the future, but it feels like it."
I say, "Not bad."
"Is this place actually real?" she asks.
"Yes, and you brought us here."
"Let's explore. We should give ourselves a break from the drug anyway."
She starts down the grassy slope away from the box. We pass a playground and then hit a walking path that runs through the park. The morning is cold and flawless. My breath steams. The grass is blanched with frost where the sun has yet to touch it, and the hardwoods that border the park are turning. The lake stands as still as glass. A quarter mile ahead, a series of elegant Y-shaped structures cut across the park at intervals of 50 meters. Only as we draw near do I realize what they are. We ride a lift up to the northbound platform and wait under the heated overhang, now 40 feet above the Greenway. A digital, interactive map emblazoned with Chicago Transit Authority identifies this route as the Red Line Express, linking South Chicago to downtown. An urgent female voice blares through a speaker overhead.
Stand clear. A train is arriving. Stand clear. A train is arriving in 5, 4, 3.
I glance up and down the line, but I don't see anything approaching.
2.
A blur of incoming movement rockets out of the tree line.
1.
A sleek 3-car train decelerates into the station, and as the doors open, that computerized female voice says,
"Please wait to board on green."
The handful of passengers who detrain and move past us are wearing workout clothes. The panel of red light above each of the open doors turns to green.
"You may board now for downtown station."
Amanda and I share a glance, shrug, and then step into the first car. It's nearly full with commuters. This isn't the L I know. It's free. No one is standing. Everyone is strapped into chairs that look like they should be bolted to a rocket sled. The word vacant hovers helpfully above each empty seat. As Amanda and I move up the aisle, the automated attendant says,
"Please find a seat. The train cannot depart the station until everyone is safely seated."
We slide into a couple of seats at the front of the car. As I lean back, padded restraints emerge from the chair and gently secure my shoulders and waist.
"Head back against your seat, please. The train is departing in 3, 2, 1.
The acceleration is smooth but intense. It shoves me deep into the cushioned seat for 2 seconds, and then we're floating along a single rail at an inconceivable speed. No sense of friction beneath us as a cityscape blurs past on the other side of the glass. Too fast for me to actually process what I'm seeing. In the distance, that fantastical skyline inches closer. The buildings don't even make sense. In the sharp morning light, it looks as if someone shattered a mirror and stood all the shards of glass upright in formation. They're too beautifully random and irregular to be man-made. Perfect in their imperfection and asymmetry, like a range of mountains or the shape of a river. The track drops. My stomach lifts. We scream through a tunnel, darkness interspersed with bursts of light that only serve to amplify the sense of disorientation and velocity. We break out of the darkness, and I grip the sides of my chair, forced forward into the restraints as the train slams to a stop. The attendant announces,
"Downtown station."
"Is this your stop?" appears as a hologram 6 inches from my face above Y? Question mark and N? Question mark. Amanda says, "Let's get off here." I swipe the Y. She does the same. Our restraints release and disappear into the seats. Rising, we exit the car with the other passengers onto the platform of a magnificent station that dwarfs New York's Grand Central. It's a soaring terminal topped with a ceiling that resembles beveled glass in the way the sunlight passes through and diffuses into the hall as scattered brilliance, projecting twittering chevrons of light onto the marble walls. The space is brimming with people. The long, croaking notes of a saxophone hang in the air. At the opposite side of the hall, we climb a daunting waterfall of steps. Everyone around us is talking to themselves. Phone calls, I'm sure, though I don't see any mobile devices. At the top of the stairs, we pass through one of a dozen turnstiles. The street is crushed with pedestrians. No cars, no traffic lights. We're standing at the base of the tallest building I've ever seen. Even in proximity, it doesn't look real. With no differentiation from floor to floor, it resembles a piece of solid ice or crystal. Pulled along by naked curiosity, we cross the street, enter the lobby of the tower, and follow the signs to the queue for the observation deck. The elevator is astonishingly fast. I have to keep swallowing to clear my ears against the constant change in pressure. After 2 minutes, the car comes to a stop. The attendant informs us that we have 10 minutes to enjoy the top. As the doors part, we're met with a chilling blast of wind. Moving out of the car, we pass a hologram that reads, "You are now 7,082 feet above street level." The elevator shaft occupies the center of the tiny observation deck, and the pinnacle of the tower is a mere 50 feet above us, the apex of the glass structure twisted into a flame-like point. Another hologram materializes as we walk toward the edge. The glass tower is the tallest building in the Midwest and the third tallest in America. It's freezing up here, the breeze steadily coming off the lake. The air feels thinner sliding into my lungs, and I register a twinge of lightheadedness. But whether from the lack of oxygen or from vertigo, I'm not sure. We reach the anti-suicide railing. My head swims. My stomach churns. It's almost too much to take in. The sparkling sprawl of the city and the profusion of neighboring towers and the vast expanse of the lake, which I can see clear across into southern Michigan. To the west and south, beyond the suburbs, the prairie glows in the morning light, 100 miles away. The tower sways. 4 states, Illinois, Indiana, Michigan, and Wisconsin, are visible on a clear day. Standing on this work of art and imagination, I feel small in the best kind of way. It's enthralling to breathe the air of a world that could build something as beautiful as this. Amanda is beside me, and we're staring down the gorgeously feminine curve of the building. It's serene and nearly silent up here. The only sound is the lonely whisper of wind. The noise of the streets below don't reach us. "Was all of this in your head?" I ask. "Not consciously, but it all feels right somehow, like a half-remembered dream." I gaze toward the northern neighborhoods, where Logan Square should be. It doesn't look anything like my home. A few feet away, I see an old man standing behind his old wife, his gnarled hands on her shoulders as she peers through a telescope, which is pointed down at the most extraordinary Ferris wheel I've ever seen. 1,000 feet tall, it looms over the lakeshore, right where Navy Pier should be. I think of Daniela, of what this other Jason too, might be doing at this moment. What he might be doing to my wife. Anger, fear, and homesickness envelop me like an illness. This world, for all its grandeur, isn't my home. It isn't even close. Ampules remaining, 42. Down the dark corridor through this in-between place again, our footfalls echoing into infinity. I'm holding the lantern and considering what I should write in the notebook when Amanda stops walking. "What's wrong?" I ask.
"Listen."
It becomes so quiet I can hear the escalated beating of my heart. And then, something impossible. A sound. Far, far down the corridor. Amanda looks at me. She whispers,
"What the fuck?"
I stare into the darkness. There's nothing to see but the dwindling light of the lantern refracting off the repeating walls. The sound becomes louder from moment to moment. It's the shuffling of footsteps. I say, "Someone's coming."
"How is that possible?"
Movement edges into the periphery of illumination. A figure coming toward us. I take a step back, and as they draw closer, I'm tempted to run, but where would I go? Might as well face it. It's a man. He's naked, his skin covered in mud or dirt or blood. Definitely blood. He reeks of it, as if he rolled around in a pool. His hair is matted, face smeared and caked so heavily it makes the whites of his eyes stand out. His hands are trembling and his fingers curled in tightly, like they've been clawing desperately at something. Only when he's 10 feet away do I realize this man is me. I step out of his way, backing up against the nearest wall to give him the widest possible berth. As he staggers past, his eyes fix on mine. I'm not even sure he sees me. He looks shell-shocked, hollowed out, like he just stepped out of hell. Across his back and shoulders, chunks of flesh have been ripped out. I say, "What happened to you?" He stops and stares at me, and then opens his mouth and makes the most terrifying sound I've ever heard. A throat-scarring scream. As his voice echoes, Amanda grabs my arm and pulls me away. He doesn't follow, just watches us go, and then shuffles on down the corridor, into that endless dark. 30 minutes later, I'm sitting in front of a door that's identical to all the rest, trying to wipe my mind and emotional register of what I just saw in the corridor. Taking a notebook from the backpack, I open it, the pen poised in my hand. I don't even have to think. I simply write the words. I want to go home. I wonder, is this what God feels? The rush that comes from having literally spoken a world into existence. And yes, this world already existed, but I connected us to it. Out of all the possible worlds, I found this one. And it's exactly, at least from the doorway of the box, what I wanted. I step down, glass crunching on the concrete beneath my shoes as afternoon light pours through the windows high above, striking a row of iron generators from another era. Although I've never seen it in daylight, I know this room. The last time I was here, a harvest moon was on the rise over Lake Michigan, and I was slumped back against one of these ancient contraptions, drugged out of my mind, staring at a man in a geisha mask who had forced me at gunpoint into the depths of this abandoned power plant. Staring, though I had no idea at the time, at myself. I couldn't have imagined the journey, the hell that actually awaited me. The box is situated in a far corner of the generator room, hidden away behind the stairs. "Well?" Amanda asks. "I think I did it. This is the last place I saw before waking up in your world." We make our way back through the derelict power plant. Outside, the sun is shining, descending. It's late afternoon, and the only sound is the lonely cry of gulls flying out over the lake. We hike west into the neighborhoods of South Chicago, walking along the shoulder like a pair of drifters. The distant skyline is familiar. It's the one I know and love. The sun keeps dropping, and we've been walking 20 minutes before it dawns on me that we haven't seen a single car on the road. "Kind of quiet, isn't it?" I ask. Amanda looks at me. The silence wasn't so noticeable out in the industrial wasteland near the lake. Here, it's startling. There are no cars out. No people. It's so quiet I can hear the current running through the power lines above us. The 87th Street CTA station is closed. No buses or trains running. The only other sign of life is a stray black cat with a corkscrew tail, slinking across the road, a rat in its jaws. Amanda says, "Maybe we should go back to the box. I want to see my home." "The vibe here is wrong, Jason. Can't you feel it? We're not going to learn anything about flying the box if we don't explore where it takes us." "Where's home?"
"Logan Square."
"Not exactly walking distance."
"So we'll borrow a car."
We cross 87th and walk a residential block of downtrodden row houses. No street sweeper has been by in weeks. There's trash everywhere, disgusting, splitting bags of it in huge piles up and down the sidewalk. Many of the windows have been boarded up. Some are covered in sheets of plastic. From most hang pieces of clothing, some red, some black. The drone of radios and televisions creeps out of a few houses. the cry of a child. But otherwise, the neighborhood stands ominously silent. Halfway down the sixth block, Amanda calls out,
"Found one!"
I cross the street toward a mid-90s Oldsmobile Cutlass Sierra. White, rusting around the edges, no hubcaps on the wheels. Through the dirty glass, I glimpse a pair of keys dangling from the ignition. Pulling open the driver's side door, I slide in behind the steering wheel.
"So we're really doing this?" Amanda asks.
I crank the engine as she climbs into the passenger side. There's a quarter tank of gas remaining. Should be enough. The windshield is so filthy, it takes 10 seconds of pummeling with wiper fluid to scrape away the grime and the dirt and the plastered-on leaves. The interstate is desolate. I've never seen anything like it. Empty in both directions as far as I can see. It's early evening now, the sun glinting off the Willis Tower. I speed north, and with each passing mile, the knot in my stomach tightens. Amanda says,
"Let's go back. Seriously, something is obviously very wrong."
If my family's here, my place is with them.
"How do you even know this is your Chicago?"
She turns on the radio and scrolls through static on the FM dial until the familiar warning pings of the emergency alert system screech through the speakers. The following message is transmitted at the request of the Illinois State Police Department. The mandatory 24-hour curfew remains in effect for Cook County. All residents are ordered to stay in their homes until further notice. The National Guard continues to monitor the safety of all neighborhoods, deliver food rations, and provide transport to the CDC quarantine zones. In the southbound lanes, a convoy of 4 camouflaged Humvees speeds by. The threat of contagion remains high. Initial symptoms include fever, severe headache, and muscle pain. If you believe that you or anyone in your home is infected, display a red piece of cloth in a street-facing window. If anyone in your home is deceased, display a black piece of cloth in a street-facing window. CDC personnel will assist as soon as they are able. Stay tuned for further details.
Amanda looks at me. "Why aren't you turning around?"
There's nowhere to park on my block, so I leave the car in the middle of the street with the engine running.
"You're out of your fucking mind," Amanda says.
I point toward the brownstone with a red skirt and black sweater hanging from the window of the master bedroom. "That's my home, Amanda."
"Just hurry and be safe, please."
I step out of the car. It's so very quiet. The streets blue in the dusk. One block up, I glimpse pale figures dragging themselves down the middle of the road. I reach the curb. The power lines are silent, the light emanating from inside the houses softer than it should be. Candlelight. There's no power in my neighborhood. Climbing the steps to the front door, I peer through the large window that looks in on the dining room. It's darkness and gloom inside. I knock. After a long time, a shadow emerges from the kitchen, trudging slowly past the dining room table toward the front door. My mouth runs dry. I shouldn't be here. This isn't even my home. The chandelier is wrong. So is the Van Gogh print above the hearth. I hear 3 locks click back. The door cracks open less than an inch, and a waft from inside creeps out that doesn't smell anything like my home. All sickness and death. Daniela holds a candle that trembles in her grasp. Even in the low light, I can see that every square inch of her exposed skin is blanketed with bumps. Her eyes look black. They're hemorrhaging. Only slivers of white remain. She says,
"Jason."
Her voice is soft and wet. Tears run from her eyes.
"Oh my God, is it you?"
She pulls the door open and staggers toward me, unsteady on her feet. It's a heart-crushing thing to feel revulsion for the one you love. I take a step back. Sensing my horror, she stops herself.
How is this possible?
She rasps.
You died.
What are you talking about?
A week ago, they carried you out of here in a body bag full of blood.
Where's Charlie? I ask. She shakes her head, and as the tears stream, coughs a bloody sob into the bend of her elbow. Dead? I ask.
No one's come to get him. He's still up in his room. He's rotting up there, Jason.
For a moment, she loses her balance, then catches herself on the doorframe.
Are you real?
She asks. Am I real? What a question. I can't speak. My throat aches with grief. Tears begin to fill my eyes. As much as I pity her, the awful truth is that I'm scared of her. My self-preservation recoiling in horror. Amanda calls from the car.
Someone's coming!
I glance up the street to see a pair of headlights rolling down through the darkness.
Jason, I will fucking leave you!
Amanda shouts.
Who is that?
Daniela asks. The rumble of the approaching engine sounds like a diesel. Amanda was right. I should have turned around the moment I realized how dangerous this place might be. This isn't my world. And still my heart feels tethered to the second floor of this house, in a bedroom where some version of my son lies dead. I want to rush up there and carry him out, but it would be my death. I move back down the steps toward the street as a Humvee pulls to a stop in the road, 10 feet from the bumper of the car we boosted in the south side. It's covered in various insignia, Red Cross, National Guard, CDC. Amanda is leaning out her window.
What the hell, Jason?
I wipe my eyes. My son is dead in there. Daniela is dying. The front passenger door of the Humvee opens, and a figure in a black biohazard suit and gas mask steps out and sights me down with an assault rifle. The voice projected through the mask belongs to a woman. She says,
"Stop right there!"
I instinctively raise my hands. Next, she swings the rifle toward the windshield of the Cutlass Sierra and walks toward the car. Says to Amanda,
"Shut that engine off!"
Amanda reaches across the center console and kills the ignition as the driver of the Humvee climbs out. I motion to Daniela, who's standing on the porch, wavering on her feet. My wife is very ill. My son is dead upstairs. The driver stares up through his mask at the facade of the brownstone.
You've got the colors properly displayed. Someone will be along to... She needs medical attention right now.
Is this your car?
Yes. Where were you planning to go?
I just wanted to get my wife to some people who could help her.
Aren't there any hospitals or...
Wait here.
Please!
Wait!
He snaps. The driver steps onto the sidewalk and climbs the stairs to where Daniela is now sitting on the highest step, leaning against the railing. He kneels in front of her, and though I hear his voice, I can't make out the words. The woman with the assault rifle covers me and Amanda. Across the street, I see firelight flickering through a window as one of our neighbors looks down on whatever is unfolding in front of my house. The driver returns. He says,
Look, the CDC camps are at capacity, have been for 2 weeks, and it wouldn't matter if you got her into one anyway. Once the eyes hemorrhage, the end is very close. I don't know about you, but I'd rather pass in my own bed than on a cot in a FEMA tent filled with dead and dying people. He looks over his shoulder. Nadia, would you grab this gentleman some auto-injectors and a mask while you're at it?
She says,
Mike, just fucking do it.
Nadia goes to the back of the Humvee and opens the cargo doors. So she's going to die?
I'm sorry.
How long?
I'd be surprised if she makes it to the morning.
Daniela groans in the darkness behind me. Nadia returns, slaps 5 auto-injectors into my hand, along with a face mask. The driver says,
Wear the mask at all times, and I know it's hard. But try not to touch her.
What is this stuff? I ask.
Morphine. If you give her all five at once, she'll slip away. I wouldn't wait. The last 8 hours are ugly.
She has no chance?
No.
Where's the cure?
There won't be one in time to save the city. They're just letting people die in their homes. He studies me through his mask. The face shield is tinted. I can't even see his eyes. If you try to leave and hit the wrong roadblock, they'll kill you, especially after dark. He turns away. I watch as they climb back into the Humvee, fire up the engine, and drive off down the block. The sun has gone below the horizon. The street is getting dark. Amanda says,
"We should go right now."
"Just give me a second."
"She's contagious."
"I'm aware."
"Jason!"
"That's my wife up there."
"No, it's a version of your wife, and if you catch whatever she has, you'll never see your real wife again."
I strap on the mask and climb the steps to the front porch. Daniela looks up as I approach. Her ruined face breaks me. She's vomited blood and black bile all over herself.
"They won't take me?" she asks.
I shake my head. I want to hold her and comfort her. I want to run away from her.
"It's okay," she says. "You don't have to pretend it's going to be all right. I'm ready."
"They gave me these," I say, setting the auto-injectors down.
"What are they?"
"A way to make it end."
"I watched you die in our bed," she says. "I watched my son die in his. I don't ever want to go back in that house. Of all the ways I thought my life would go, I never imagined this."
"This isn't how your life turned out, only how it ended. Your life was beautiful." The candle falls out of her hand and extinguishes on the concrete, the wick smoking. I say, "If I give you all of these at once, this can be over. Is that what you want?" She nods, tears and blood running down her cheeks. I pull a purple cap off one of the auto-injectors, hold the end against her thigh, and press the button on the opposite end. Daniela barely even flinches as the spring-loaded syringe fires a dose of morphine into her system. I set up the next four and administer them all in quick succession. The effect is nearly instantaneous. She falls back against the wrought iron railing, and her black eyes glass over as the drug takes hold. "Better?" I ask. She almost smiles, then says, her words thickening,
"I know I'm just hallucinating this, but you're my angel. You came back to me. I was so afraid to die alone in that house."
The dusk deepens. The first stars appear in the eerily black skies above Chicago.
"I'm so lightheaded," she says.
I think of all the evenings we've sat on this porch, drinking, laughing, bullshitting with the neighbors passing by as the street lamps up and down the block winked on. In this moment, my world seems so safe and perfect. I see now. I took all that comfort for granted. It was so good, and there were so many ways it could have all gone to pieces. Daniela says,
"I wish you could touch me, Jason."
Her voice has become hoarse and brittle, little more than a whisper. Her eyes close. Each cycle of her respiration becomes longer by a second or two, until she stops breathing altogether. I don't want to leave her out here, but I know I shouldn't touch her. Rising, I move to the door and step inside. The house is silent and dark, and the presence of death clings to my skin. I pass the candlelit walls of the dining room, move through the kitchen, and into the study. The hardwood floor creaks under my footsteps, the only sound in the house. At the foot of the stairs, I stop and stare up into the darkness of the second floor, where my son lies rotting in his bed. I feel the pull to go up there, like the irresistible gravity of a black hole.
but I resist. I grab the blanket draped over the couch, take it outside, and cover Daniela's body. Then I close the door to my house and walk down the steps and away from the horror. I get in the car, start the engine, look over at Amanda. Thanks for not leaving me.
I should have.
I drive away. Some parts of the city have power. Some are in the black. My eyes keep welling up. I can hardly see to drive.
Amanda says, Jason, this isn't your world. That wasn't your wife. You can still go home and find them.
Intellectually, I know she's right. But emotionally, that just ripped my guts out. I am hardwired to love and protect that woman. We're passing through Bucktown. In the distance, an entire city block is hurling 100-foot flames at the sky. The interstate is dark and empty. Amanda reaches over and pulls the mask off my face. The smell of death from inside my home lingers in my nose. I can't shake it. I keep thinking of Daniela, lying dead under a blanket on our front porch. As we pass to the west of downtown, I glance out my window. There's just enough starlight to profile the towers. They're black, lifeless. Amanda says, Jason?
What?
There's a car following us. I look in the rearview mirror. With no lights, it looks like a phantom riding my bumper. Blinding high beams in red and blues kick on, sending splinters of light through the interior of the car. A voice booms through a megaphone behind us. Pull your vehicle onto the shoulder! Panic swells. We have nothing to defend ourselves with. We can't outrun anything in this piece of shit. I take my foot off the gas, watch the speedometer needle swing counterclockwise. Amanda says,
You're stopping?
Yes.
Why?
I ease down on the brake pedal, and as our speed falls, I veer onto the shoulder and bring the car to a stop.
Jason,
Amanda grabs my arm.
What are you doing?
In the side mirror, I watch a black SUV pull to a stop behind us. Turn off your vehicle and drop the keys out the window.
Jason!
Just trust me. This is your last warning. Turn off the car and drop the keys out the window. Any attempt to flee will be met with lethal force. A mile or so back, more headlights appear. I shift the car into park and kill the lights. Then I lower my window several inches, stick my arm through, and pretend to drop a set of keys outside. The driver's side door to the SUV opens, and a man in a gas mask steps out with his weapon already drawn. I throw the car back into gear, hit the lights, and floor the accelerator. I hear a gunshot over the roar of the engine. A bullet hole stars the windshield. Then another. One rips into the cassette deck. Looking back, I see the SUV now several hundred yards down the shoulder. The speedometer is at 60 and climbing.
How far are we from our exit? Amanda asks.
A mile or two.
There's a bunch of them coming.
I see them.
Jason, if they catch us?
I know. I'm doing a little over 90 now, the engine straining to maintain speed, the RPMs inching into the red. We blow past a sign giving notice that our exit is a quarter mile ahead on the right. At this speed, we reach it in a matter of seconds. I hit the exit at 75 and brake hard. Neither of us are buckled in. The inertia slams Amanda into the glove box and shoves me forward into the steering wheel. At the end of the ramp, I take a brutal left turn through a stop sign, tire squealing, rubber burning. It slings Amanda against her door and nearly sends me flying into her seat. As I drive across the overpass, I count five sets of flashing lights on the interstate, the closest SUV now speeding onto the exit ramp with two Humvees in tow. We tear through the vacated streets of South Chicago. Amanda leans forward, stares out the windshield. What is it? I ask. She's looking at the sky.
I see lights up there.
Like a helicopter?
Exactly.
I screamed through empty intersections, past the shuttered L station, and then were clear of the ghetto, speeding alongside abandoned warehouses and train yards. In the boondocks of the city.
They're getting close, Amanda says.
A round thunks into the trunk of the car, followed by three more in fast succession, like someone taking a hammer to metal.
She says, "That's a machine gun.
Get down on the floorboard." I can hear the anthem of sirens drawing near. This antiquated sedan is no match for what's coming. Two more rounds pierce the back window and the windshield. One rips through the middle of Amanda's seat. Through the bullet-riddled glass, I see the lake straight ahead. I say, "Hang on, we're almost there." I make a hard right onto Pulaski Drive, and as a trio of bullets peppers the rear passenger door, I cut the lights. The first few seconds of driving without headlights feels like we're flying through total darkness. Then my eyes begin to adjust. I can see the pavement ahead, the black silhouettes of structures all around us. It's as dark as the countryside out here. I take my foot off the gas, but I don't touch the brake. Glancing back, I see two SUVs make aggressive turns onto Pulaski. Up ahead, I can just make out the pair of familiar smokestacks spearing the starlit sky. Our speed is under 20 miles per hour, and though the SUVs are gaining fast, I don't think their high beams have touched us yet. I see the fence. Our speed keeps dropping. I steer across the road, and the grill smashes into the locked gate, splitting the doors apart. We roll slowly into the parking lot, and as I maneuver around the toppled light poles, I look back toward the road. The sirens are getting louder. Three SUVs streak past the gate, trailed by two Humvees with machine gun turrets mounted to their roofs. I kill the engine. In the new silence, I listen to the sirens fading away. Amanda climbs up from the floorboard as I grab our pack from the back seat. The slams of our doors bounce off the brick building straight ahead. We move toward the crumbling structure and all that's left of the original signage, Cargo Power. A helicopter buzzes overhead, a brilliant spotlight scraping across the parking lot. Now I hear a revving engine. A black SUV skids sideways across Pulaski. Headlights blind us. As we run toward the building, a man's voice through a megaphone orders us to stop. I step through the hole in the brick facade, give Amanda a hand inside. It's pitch black. Ripping open the pack, I quickly dig out the lantern. The light reveals the destroyed front office, and the sight of this place in the dark takes me back to that night with Jason too, when he walked me naked and at gunpoint into another version of this old building. We move out of the first room, the lantern piercing the darkness. Down a hallway, faster and faster. Our footsteps pounding the rotten floor. Sweat runs down my face, stings my eyes. My heart beats so hard it rattles my chest. I'm gasping for breath. Voices call after us. I look back, see lasers cutting through the black and splotches of green from what I assume are night vision goggles. I hear the noise of radios and whispered voices and the rotors of the helicopter bleeding through the walls. A torrent of gunfire fills the hallway, and we flatten ourselves against the ground until the shooting stops. Struggling back onto our feet, we push on with even more urgency. At a junction, I take us down a different hall, mostly sure it's the right way, though it's impossible to be certain in the dark. We finally emerge onto the metal platform at the top of the open stairs that lead down into the generator room. We descend. Our pursuers are so close, I can pick out three distinct voices reverberating through the last hallway. Two men, one woman. I move off the last step. Amanda right on my heels as heavy footfalls clang on the stairs above us. Two red dots crisscross my path. I sidestep and keep running, straight into the darkness ahead, where I know the box has to be. Gunshots ring out above us as two figures in full biohazard gear launch off the bottom of the stairs, hurtling toward us. The box stands 50 feet ahead, the door open,
and the metallic surface gently diffusing the light of our incoming lantern. Gunshot. I feel something zip by my right ear like a passing hornet. A bullet strikes the door with a spark of fire. My ear burns. A man behind us screams, "There's nowhere to go!" Amanda is first into the box. Then I cross the threshold, turn, dig my shoulder into the door. The soldiers are 20 feet away, so close I can hear them panting through their gas masks. They open fire, and the blinding muzzle flashes and the bullets chinking into the metal of the box are the last I see and hear of that nightmare world. We shoot up immediately and start walking down the corridor. After a while, Amanda wants to stop, but I can't. I need to keep moving. I walk for a full hour, through an entire cycle of the drug, my ear bleeding all over my clothes, until the corridor collapses back into a single box. I throw off the pack, cold, coated in dried sweat. Amanda is standing in the center of the box, her skirt dirty and ripped, sweater torn off completely from our run through the abandoned power plant. As she sets the lantern on the floor, something inside of me releases. The strength, the tension, the anger, the fear, everything flooding out at once in a stream of tears and uncontrollable sobbing. Amanda turns off the lantern. I crumple down against the cold wall, and she pulls me over into her lap, runs her fingers through my hair.